Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome to What's Eric Eating? Culture Map's look at all things Houston bars and restaurants. I'm your host, Culture Map editor Eric Sandler. Today is a special show in the sense that we were going to do this last week, but we got pushed back by Hurricane Beryl, Hurricane whatever. It was a real B, I know that. We did this last year, talked about the bear with a very special guest. I will introduce him. I will stop messing around. I will introduce my guest. He is the owner of Theodore Rex, a partner in Thoroughfare Hospitality, the company behind Squabble, Better Luck Tomorrow, Anvil, Refuge, other things.
Catbird.
Oh, at Catbird's, yes. Justin Yu, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Eric, how are you doing?
Good. You know, we did this last year. We talked about season two of The Bear because in some ways, there are certain aspects of your career that are similar to our hero, Carmen Berzano. He is a Food and Wine Best New Chef. You are a Food and Wine Best New Chef. He is a James Beard Award winner. You are a James Beard Award winner. He worked at a bunch of really great restaurants before opening his own place. You worked at a bunch of really great restaurants before opening your place. So I want to talk about The Bear Season 3 with you. I'm delighted you're here. But before we do that, let me just ask you about your restaurants, because I know we're recording this on Monday, July 15th. Theodore Rex has been closed since the storm came in. Squabble has been closed since the storm came in. So what is the status of your restaurants?
We're very fortunate. Squabble had power back last night, and they are working furiously to make sure the restaurant is clean. Chef owner Mark Clayton and Terry Williams, the general manager there, organizing the staff, they had to throw away everything, anything that was frozen. We tried our very best to save as much product as possible and to give it to staff members that needed them. But this is just the entire ordeal and situation from something that we can expect, like a hurricane, and things that we can't expect, and like how frustrating the situation with our energy grid is just a lot. I just wanted to, speak for our restaurants, but just overall, I hope in that people come back out in full force to enjoy all of Houston's great restaurants. Please support them. I assume that is as frustrating as it has been for us. It's been just as frustrating for other restaurants as well, not having any idea when power's coming back on, sorting through already a hurricane, just like the rest of Houston. Just want to kind of ask everybody to, one, have patience with us. We are trying our very best to be as hospitable as we possibly can in the restaurant industry. And two, just come out and have a great time when we're able to have you. It's the one thing that'll keep all the things that are going on at home off our minds, and looking forward to having everybody, not only in our restaurants, but all the really great restaurants that we used to.
Well, and I have to say, it's been a minute since I've been into T-Rex, but you have a relatively new chef de cuisine. And I know you've made some changes to the menu, and you brought a new wine director on board. So some exciting stuff happening at T-Rex, and I know I'm due for a visit.
Well, we can't wait to have you. Can't wait to have everybody come join us and see Frank Homicia, our new chef de cuisine. He's been with us for a while before he became chef de cuisine. He took over for Caitlin Seat, who left after 7 years. And we have a new wine list coming on, a new wine buyer coming on. A lot of really fun and exciting things happening over at Theodore Rex. just like all nice restaurants, you know, we're one of those that has constant changes and one that tries to keep it as exciting and as fresh as possible. And we're doing our very best to make sure that we hit our goal, which is to, as you've stated a few times, and I say it pretty regularly, we want to be the best restaurant in Houston, whatever that means. But we will always try our best to make sure you have a great time and have something new and exciting to eat and something comforting to eat every time you come in.
All right. Well, I'm glad that you're on the path to reopening. I look forward to my meals at both Squabble and T-Rex. I mean, Mark was a James Beard Award semifinalist this year. Thought that was very well deserved.
Very much so.
And yeah, so all right. Let's get into the Bear. Season 3. This is spoilers throughout. Like it's been out for a few weeks now, so hopefully if you're listening to this, you've seen season 3, you've watched season 3, but if you haven't, major spoilers throughout.
Warning. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert. Spoiler alert.
You've been warned, right?
What's this?
So non-negotiables. That's how restaurants at the highest level operate.
Push boundaries.
Constantly evolve through creativity.
Vibrant collaboration. That's demented.
These are non-negotiables.
I can sense the sarcasm.
No. Not sarcasm. Snark. Contempt even.
This is documenting kind of the beginning, maybe the first. It's the time's a little bit fuzzy, but maybe the first 4 to 6 weeks of opening the restaurant. We pick right up where we left off at the end of season 2, which was their friends and family, their kind of practice service. And then we get right into the machinations of opening an ambitious, independently owned restaurant. Justin, before we get into the specifics, what were your kind of overall thoughts on season 3?
I mean, overall thoughts as far as season 2 goes, I really, you know, I recognize that there has to be a lot of character development with a lot of the people that are associated with the Bear. Honestly, given a choice, I really enjoyed the first 2 seasons probably more than I enjoyed the 3rd season. I think there was, but I think it was some necessary evils as far as like character development goes. That being said, I thought it was an interesting season, especially looking into the background of everybody involved in the restaurant. And I think that's important to set up what I think is the final season of the Bear for next season. You never know. But I do wish kind of that they spent a little bit more time at the restaurant. But that being said, I still thought it was a great watch. I really enjoyed it. And I loved all the chef cameos, which is maybe more of a shout out to me being a foodie or, you know, oh God, I can't believe I just called myself that. Me being a fan of food and restaurants. Fan of food and restaurants. I'm going to get such shit for that.
We're gonna clip that and I'm just gonna run that on Instagram so it can live forever.
great. I can't wait to get razzing from Bobby Hugel for that. He's never gonna let me live it. Really loved like all the chef cameos. Really enjoyed all that. And also, you know, during like the last episode, I felt as if there was a lot of candid talk about restaurants. So I really think that was, you know, a lot for like the people who love restaurants, love high-end restaurants. And I thought that was great as well.
Yeah, no, I think the chef cameos kind of put the Bear in this larger context and kind of the world of restaurants and kind of explain why people like you who've devoted your life to working at owning, running restaurants, love about the show. And it kind of the way that it depicts work life and the camaraderie of the team. I think it's, you know, obviously it's just been so influential. And so I did enjoy that final episode with the restaurant funeral. I do want to talk about some aspects of that, but I just want to start with just the kind of the fundamental question of, do you think it accurately depicted the challenges of opening an ambitious, independently owned restaurant?
I really think it does. I think I remember seeing in the trailers, I was really excited for this season because it depicted kind of a Carmy he wrote down in the first episode, these non-negotiables about the restaurant. These are the things we absolutely have to do to be a great restaurant or even a Michelin-starred restaurant. And that really, unfortunately, reminded me of myself. Definitely kind of was manic almost in a way about the success of the restaurant, the way that it was perceived, what these restaurants had to absolutely do in order to be this type of restaurant that you wanted to be, the changing of the menus every day, the way that everything had to be laid out, and the frustration that it was. You know, one thing that I think was an interesting dynamic was that Carmi made sure everybody knew that every little second and every little moment, every little angle counted. And it's almost, again, in that very manic form, we take it almost as a personal insult sometimes when people don't live up to those expectations, even though us as chefs are generally not the best communicators that these are the expectations in the first place.
Yeah, I thought it was so interesting that they're not real explicit about this, but the first episode especially is kind of his memories of his training, the places he worked and the lessons he learned. And we see him at Danielle in New York City. We see him at Ever in Chicago working with, Chef, I can't remember the character's name, the Olivia Colman, right? I think the actress, her character. We see him overseas. We see him at Noma with Rene Redzepi. And he rises through the ranks really quickly. Like one day we see him shelling peas, like alongside Luca. And then like a scene later, he's very clearly in charge and Luca's not performing up to expectations, right? It all kind of came pretty easily to him until he gets to the unnamed restaurant with Joel McHale's character, David, whatever David's last name is, that sort of looks like 11 Madison Park, but isn't really 11 Madison Park, right? Like it's a little bit fuzzy about kind of that restaurant isn't named. They don't put it in that context, but this very ambitious restaurant where, he kind of meets the limits of what, everything came easily until he starts working for Joel McHale's character. And then it's really hard and he gets criticized and mocked and belittled and demeaned and shamed. But at the same time, it inspires him to create the dish that Sydney eats, that gives her that aha moment, that leads her to want to work with him and leads to the creativity of the Bear. So, I don't know how you sort of came up or what your working experiences were like prior to opening T-Rex, but maybe just talk about a little bit about that journey of the evolution of a chef and kind of what it takes to being pushed by a mentor, maybe even far beyond the bounds of what's reasonable, but in that pursuit of becoming great.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I started cooking when I was 16 years old, and I came through a lot of different types of kitchens, and I came through a lot of different types of kitchens that were very similar to the ones that Carmi came through. And I came through ones that had a lot more humble beginnings. My first job was at Azuma on Kirby. My second one was at Papado's on I-10. So those obviously are run very differently. But when I started cooking at a certain level from my externship in culinary school, I cooked in Chicago and I cooked in Napa Valley. Those, I would say that the restaurant that I was cooking at in Napa Valley, was a restaurant called Ubuntu. It was a Michelin-starred restaurant. Probably at the time was maybe the closest to the French Laundries and the Nomas that Carmi went to. And then I went to Copenhagen and did a couple stages in Belgium and did a couple stages. And that level of intensity, sometimes it's almost like a pissing match of how ridiculous you can be as far as the ways that people think, oh, well, this is an amazing restaurant. And it's a level of dedication to the small details. Anything, when I was watching it with my girlfriend, she was asking, what is he doing with the little skewer cleaning And he was getting all the little crumbs out of the cleaning out of the oven. And we used to absolutely have to do that. There's little things like the way that they cut the tape. You know, at this point, you know, they use the tape dispenser, but then they also use a pair of scissors. That's again, one step further than I'd ever done, but I still really care about the tape not being torn. I care about it having straight lines. And again, it's just that idea of like, hey, if you work in a clean, organized, dedicated, push yourself really hard, try your dedication every single day. Say yes, chef, no matter how ridiculous the situation is, to press your chef whites before service every single day. You know, I was really lucky to do a month-long stage at Geranium in Copenhagen, and that was the most intense. Something as simple as the little plastic tray that you put your garnishes on before you put it on the plate had to all be the same size and the same color. So part of my job was running around the kitchen finding the same color, same size one for my station, because there are four different stations with three to four cooks on each one of them. They all had to look the same, because to them, that's what really matters. So it really depends on like what level of cooking that you're looking for. Again, sometimes it's just how ridiculous it can be. It really pushes that last 5 to 10% on, I wouldn't even say what makes a restaurant great, but how unique and how creative that they and how exact all the food is. Everything, I'm sure you know, but at this point, everything is down to the gram a lot of times in these restaurants. And to them, that is really, really important, that everybody gets the same great exacting meal every single time.
Yeah, no, I thought, you know, the details matter, right? That the conversation with Uncle Jimmy about chargers, you know, why do we have chargers, right? Nobody eats on them. We pick them up and then we give them to somebody else, right? Like you never eat on their plates. You don't eat on. It's the most ridiculous waste of money. That was a big one, right? But this is how it's done in fine dining restaurants. This is what you do. You have to have a charger.
Waste being a luxury at that point, right? And so, you know, I don't think that I personally do not love those things anymore. You'll very rarely find myself in a tasting menu restaurant where they have chargers. Obviously, I love going to and seeing new things, but you know, those things don't matter to me as a chef anymore. And I think it's mattering less and less in our world, not the bear world these days. I think unless you're in Europe and you see 50 best restaurants, things like that. I think, to you know, I don't want to criticize these three Michelin star restaurants, but a lot of times it's like the luxury is in sometimes how wasteful you can be, and how much detail that you can put on the plate, but sometimes that's what you have to do in order to get that idea of what that level of restaurant is.
Well, and I mean, Carmi's very open about this. You know, he wants to earn a Michelin star for the Bear. Sydney wants to earn a Michelin star. What did you think? The thing that kind of struck me was that one of his non-negotiables was that the menu would change every day. And that surprised me both from a practicality standpoint, that's a really hard way to run a restaurant, but also from the sense of, if you want a Michelin star, I know consistency is one of their big criteria. So it seemed like, and that was reflected in the scene with the photographer from the newspaper, like, oh yeah, give me the duck dish. Like, oh wait, which duck dish? That was weeks ago. Right. And we did six different preparations. So what were your thoughts on changing the menu every day? Cause I couldn't decide whether that was maybe like, obviously it increased the drama for the show, but maybe that was like a little bit unrealistic for a restaurant of this type.
Yeah, there are restaurants that are out there, you know, I've worked in a couple of them, that if you had eight at the restaurant two consecutive nights, you would have two different meals. And, you know, again, that's really tough, first of all, but also too, as somebody who tried, and so I'm sorry, opening staff of Oxheart, I'm so, so sorry, but I tried that for the first 2 weeks, and oh my gosh, I can't even think of what type of food we put out sometimes. We tried our very best to do it. And it's I think personally, unless you have a restaurant with a staff of a certain size, with probably a lot of unpaid workers that do a lot of like detail work, it's really, really tough to change the menu every single night. There are things that you can change, but also like, I want the classics. I think that it is a great goal to push for. And I think that it really shows the strength of your execution and how good you are at your craft. But, you know, personally, you know, there's restaurants out there that have two menus. One is like usually like a seasonal menu or then a classics menu. I almost always order a classics menu because these are things that they've been refining over and over again for years upon years upon years. And those are the items in the dishes that, you know, honestly, that I find most exciting because it stands the test of time. These are things that, you know, the chef are very, excited about and that's why they serve it every single night. Do I think there are restaurants that really want to put out new dishes every single night? Absolutely. And that's so much fun, you know. But do I think that that is extremely exacting unless you have a, you know, very large staff that can do all that work? I don't know if that's something that I would do personally.
Well, and also from a customer perspective, right? Like if I go to Theodore Rex, like I want the tomato toast. I want the beef and butter dumplings. You know, there's other things that can change or float around, but certain staples, I kind of ground the, you know, a diner's experience.
Yeah. I mean, you know, spoiler alert, the beef and butter dumplings are coming off the menu sometime soon. But, yeah, there's dishes that, you know, a lot of people have worked on over a long period of time. We've found the best ways to do that. It's, you know, but, you know, we as chefs and cooks get tired of doing the exact same thing every single day. So I really think that, you know, at some point, my hope is that Carmi in the show finds that balance of like what is important to him that still allows him to push himself to the highest level that he wants to hit. But also he finds his classics. I completely understand that that level of ambition. It's an extremely ambitious way of cooking and dining, one that I personally am not talented enough to pull off.
All right. So let me ask you, you said, you know, you're not a big, you know, even though when Oxheart opened, it was a tasting menu, Theodore Rex is a la carte. So obviously you've moved away from it. The Bear is a tasting menu. Would you eat at the Bear? Did it look delicious? Did the food look like something you wanted to eat?
Actually, it's interesting. Like the initial menu didn't, I think you asked me this last time around too. Like the initial menu didn't. Yeah. It looked a little big to me. And it was interesting to me because for as shitty of a chef or sorry, as mean of a chef as the Joel McHale character was, like, there were things that as you were watching the season go on, you're like, where he says, the more you subtract, the better the dish is. I truly, truly believe in that. And like that's the best dishes are edited, right? Because a lot of times you put an idea that is just half thought out on a plate to start. And that's how you find a lot of restaurants. That's why I wish people give restaurants a second chance if they've been going in the first 3 to 6 months and maybe they've been talked about on a certain podcast. And get a chance to go back around and try it again, because a lot of times you'll find that editing is the best way to make a dish really kind of sing. And so as the show went on and he kind of subtracted like items on the dishes, however many sauces were on the original, the food looked much better and more concise and more clear. And yeah, I think, you know, the Bear is probably one of those places that would be like, oh, okay, I'm going to give it 6 months and then I'll go.
You know, I think just even from the meal we see at friends and family versus the menu that they serve once they open, you know, making that decision, for example, to like take the like giant steak for two and just turn it into like one really great slice of Wagyu. I mean, that just makes so much sense to me because that no table was ever going to have the like just the stomach capacity to eat that giant porterhouse or whatever it was they were serving.
Right.
But, you know, one slice of really great beef per diner just seems so much more appropriate. And I have to say, like that little mirepoix broth situation that they did is like the a muse or the first course.
Right.
I love a soup. It just looks so good.
That's actually really funny. I was like, we were watching, and I actually watched an episode with Justin Van, who's one, my best friend, but also two, the wine buyer over at Nathie's Hustle. And I just remember looking at that dish, and I was like, he was like, that is a you dish. I was like, shut up. And I'm like, looking at it, I was like, I would totally put that dish on a menu. And we have, and so like a nice clear broth, a nice warm broth in the winter, or a nice cool broth in the summer is something that you kind of want to open up with. And I thought that was great. I would totally go to the, I probably would fanboy out a little bit over at the Bear.
Yeah. The other thing that didn't, and this is so personal to me, but you know, they're very focused on the review from the Chicago Tribune or whatever. But it occurred to me that if a restaurant like that opened in Houston, right, where the chef was a hometown boy who had left and worked at the French Laundry and Danielle and 11 Madison Park or its equivalent and Noma, that we would be freaking out, right? There would be culture map, multiple culture map articles around the opening. He would, like, Carmi would be on the podcast. Sydney would be on the podcast. Like, you know, the two of them would be on the podcast together, probably. Like, they'd be nominated for Tastemaker Awards. There would be a whole bunch of, like, you know, Eater would be covering it. Infatuation would be covering it. All these other people would be covering it long before there was, you know, long before Allison Cook or whoever got around to writing a formal review. And so that they didn't, like, we don't see influencers, we don't see other interviews, like, we don't see any of that, like, media engagement. They don't seem to have PR. Like, I just thought, like, that kind of aspect of, like, modern restaurant life was maybe the one thing that they didn't quite capture. And I obviously, I know you can't do anything, and you can't do everything. And I know that's personal to me, but did you have any thoughts about kind of the waiting on the review as like this make or break moment for the restaurant?
Yeah. I mean, I think it harkens back to a time that honestly was not that far away ago. You know, being a chef these days with as much access as people have to chefs, inclusive of Instagram, first looks with Culture Map, interviews with, you know, Eater, you know, and then like the national magazines, especially if you've done that ahead of time, being a chef is very, very different than when I first opened up Oxheart. This restaurant seemed to be in a time where written media was extremely important, and you know, it used to be it written media reviews. I would say saved Oxheart, honestly. I don't know about saved, but really pushed itself to being very busy and trying to push itself to being a financially viable restaurant. Right.
Yeah, I mean, we could just be explicit for people. I mean, you'd been open for about 6 months when Allison Cook said Oxheart was the number one restaurant in Houston and gave you a level of credibility with people who, like, a certain class of diners who maybe wouldn't have gone otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. They, you know, wouldn't have gone there, had no idea where the restaurant is. We're not necessarily in an area that's very populated. And then made, more so than anything, made people curious and made people curious to see what this guy, this 27-year-old coming back to Houston was doing, even though we did a pop-up a year before. And it really kind of gave us the ability to push ourselves a little bit harder. I think that Carmi kind of handled it the same way that I personally handled it. I thought that, you know, doing this would make or break us. If we got a bad review, we would probably not make it to the level that we really wanted it to. And that's a really tough thing, because people ask a lot of times, are you cooking for yourself or are you cooking for the critics? And you want to answer one, but you know the other is coming around too, right? You know, You can't have a restaurant with no people in it, and you can't
run a website that nobody reads, right? Like, you gotta,
right.
You know.
And so, you know, again, like, I think that seeing, I don't think that this was the restaurant or the Bear depicted a restaurant and a chef in something that's a little bit more of a modern time where you have to be more engaging. You have to have, you know, PR capabilities. You have to have be able to talk intelligently to the Eric Sandlers of the world and the Allison Cooks of the world. And not come off as standoffish or anything like that. That's like this new, weird, very different thing in over the last several years, especially to, you know, like how important social media is. It's like, I bucked real hard against the trend. I was like, I am never getting Instagram ever. And, that changed very quickly.
Yeah. I mean, right. That we don't see either Sugar or Sydney or somebody running the Bears Instagram account and like taking pictures and posting it. That is, I mean, because they would have to be doing something, right? They have to be engaging with people on some level.
Yeah. I mean, the written media and the internet media is just not enough these days. That's not how people accept their information these days. They see it in all different ways.
You mentioned that last episode, and I thought that it was so, so interesting. We see all these people kind of sitting around a table, Christina Tosi and Will Gridera and the Sanchez.
Rosio, yeah. Rosio Sanchez.
Yeah. You know,
Malcolm Livingston, who's a pastry chef over at WD-50 and then over at NOMA. Chini Kwan from Kasama, Will Gyarda, who was at Blue Madison Park for such a long time and Make It Nice Hospitality for such a long time. Just the kind of a who's who. I mean, Grant Eckert's from Millennia, 3-star Michelin restaurant, one of the most foremost avant-garde chefs that, you know, I remember. I went to his restaurant very early in my career and was just amazed. So definitely like that who's who in the last couple episodes.
Right. And they're all kind of shooting the shit about, they're all kind of sitting around the table, like shooting the shit about, especially like Christina Tosi and I'm sorry, the other pastry chef.
Rosalia.
Yeah. They both work for Wiley Dufresne. And they're talking about the different ways that Wiley kind of pushed them to become the chefs that they are. And this idea of like a culinary legacy, even at it's a real restaurant in Chicago, but a fictional restaurant in the show where, you know, we see the chef de cuisine, like, he's planning, you know, now that it's closing, he's planning to open his own place. He's talking to Sydney about working for him and kind of taking charge. And this idea of like, you know, we build on the experience. We stand on the shoulders of giants. We build on the legacy of these lessons that we've learned and we teach people. And then they go on and surpass us in some level. But this idea of legacy is a big theme of season three. And so I just... obviously, you've worked for great chefs and you've trained some chefs who've gone on to do some pretty impressive work other places. I mean, God, anybody who's been to Burger Chen, you know, Chef Willett worked for you. It was part of the opening crew at Oxard. And, you know, I'm very excited about Barbacana and Christian Hernandez. And he worked for you at Oxard before going on to do some work in New York and Mexico City. So just talk to me about legacy and this idea of like, being on this continuum.
I mean, opening a restaurant like that has a lot of selfish aspects of that, right? Opening, especially a tasting menu restaurant, is inherently, I think, a very selfish thing because you're telling your story. It's also why when people don't do well in those restaurants, you feel so personally insulted, even though it's probably your fault that they didn't do something right. That it kind of works out that way. That level of legacy, I think, is especially because it is a restaurant, a lot of us don't necessarily have or want children. That's like, it's kind of like our way of seeing, you know, the work that we put out into this world move on. And so I think it is really important. It's an important ideal in the back of our minds. As far as mentorship goes and as far as legacy goes. And a lot of us aren't well suited for that. A lot of us have ended up in the kitchen because we aren't good at that. We're good at the one thing. We're good at cooking. Cooking doesn't necessarily give you all the soft skills, though, to be a people person. I was, and sometimes I assume that I still am, or just maybe not the best communicator and not the best teacher, not the best mentor, and something that I've had to grow and learn a lot about over the last several years. And, you know, I think that that idea behind it is just, you want to leave, it's just like everybody, you want to leave that lasting impact on the world. Ours just happens to be in the medium of food, you know? So it's like, so it's sometimes funny to be like, oh, I know where he got that from. And people will look at my, the food that comes out of T-Rex or back of an ox heart, and like, there are straight up copies of things that, that we've done. And there, and, but then the growth that comes from that, right. You know, your way to put a new spin on something that you've done before. And it's also really exciting to see go out there, you know, be able to see a Caitlin or a Willett or a Mark kind of have seen something that, that has happened in the restaurant and something that is now very much theirs. So it's always an exciting, it's like exciting to see people move on and to do things on their own. And I, more so than anything, I'm just really excited that it's a contribution to the culinary world.
Well, and I do think that is one measure of a chef's overall achievement or the greatness of someone's career. You know, if you look at like all the people who have worked for Danielle Ballou, for example, you know, even, I mean, even here in Houston, right, Aaron Bluedorn has like set the whole city on fire. You know, worked for Danielle for 10 years, or even Becky Masson, right? Worked at Danielle and then came to Houston. And even though she's making cookies and cakes and ice cream, but all with that like extra level of refinement, that extra level of training that comes from those experiences in New York.
Yeah. I mean, those are the things that excite us as chefs and owners, and especially as we get older, a lot of it starts off as like, again, just very selfish, very like tunnel visioned. And then you expand out and you probably burn out after a while. And it's more exciting to see the work of other people and to cheer other people on, even though I think some chefs are maybe a little bit more are negative towards that. I don't see it that way at all. I think it's really, really exciting to see people that have gone on from your kitchen that you were at and see them succeed in other kitchens and then their own kitchen in the future, hopefully.
And then I just want to ask you about one other, there's one other scene that really struck me about life in a restaurant. And then obviously, if you have any other thing you want to talk about, you're welcome to, but there's an episode that focuses on Tina and how she went from kind of an office job to being a cook. And she sits down with Carmi's brother, Michael, and they have this conversation where he offers her a job. And I don't have the exact quote right in front of me, but basically he says, you know, this job is so hard and there are some days when it just sucks, but then there are other days when it comes together and you make a bunch of money in tips and it's so much fun. And I really like, just from knowing people in the restaurant business, I thought that really resonated. And so I just wanted to know what you thought about that scene.
Yeah. I mean, like, look at this past week with the hurricane, right? Sometimes it really sucks. Sometimes, you know, a lot of people, I think, over glorify restaurants sometimes, but man, it beats you down mentally constantly. Anything from labor going out of the way, someone not showing up. And I wake up every single morning hoping that there's less than 15 texts about problems that are going on in the restaurant. And so, yeah, it sometimes it really, really sucks. There's every single morning I check whether or not the power's on over at T-Rex. sometimes an oven is broken. Sometimes someone doesn't show up, and those things are really, really tough. But the things that really, really make it worth it are when the team is together and it's really working. All the little systems that you put together are really clicking. People are growing, and you get to see successes where success is hard. You get to see smiling faces, ideally. You get to see people enjoy themselves, and ideally, you also make a lot of money, or just enough money to help pay the bills and to make sure that people are well taken care of. And those are the things that really make running a restaurant worth it. It's the people that you work with, the times that you know that you have their back, and that they have yours as well, and that you rely on each other. And as a business, though, I kind of buck at the idea these days of of restaurants being families. I think that it's overused and probably abused, but that idea of a restaurant where you're able to be a part of the team, even though you're an owner or you're the chef, really, really working. And like, those are the days you go home to the bar, you go home and have a beer, and you like look back and you're like, man, that was awesome. That really, really worked. People were super happy. I'm ready to go to sleep, relax, wake up and go on and do it again.
Right. Cause you could say, we want to make money, and of course making money is important, but you're not going to make a lot of money, or, certainly not with one restaurant. Maybe if you open enough of them or you get big enough, but the money is not the primary driver.
Right. I did have one question about a scene that I wanted to ask you.
Oh, please.
All right. So this was like the most riveting scene in the entirety of the show. It's the last episode, and Carmy is in the bathroom hallway catching Joel McHale's character about the way that, he was treated and how he's in your mind. So I think the actual quote was, I think about you every day. And then Joel McHale says, well, I don't think about you at all. But like that, how do you think about that? How would you think of like that character development, especially on the very first episode, seeing Carmy go through him coming up as a great cook, a great chef?
Well, it tied into something because I went recently to when David Chang came to town. He did that conversation with Chris Shepherd at Stages Theater, and one of the things he talked about, he was like, "Look, this isn't politically correct, and people get mad at me when I say this, but to become truly great, you have to put the work in, right? You can't do it in a 40-hour week or a 50-hour week. You have to spend 80 or 100 hours a week. And if you work at one restaurant for 40 hours a week, then you should find a second job and work at another restaurant for another 40 hours. That you really have to push yourself to achieve like greatness." And that he worries about kind of the younger generation, even recognizing that it was abusive and even recognizing that what was asked of people was unreasonable, but that this new, more employee-friendly work environment, he's not confident that people can innovate without like just putting the hours in, right? That kind of Malcolm Gladwell 10,000 hours kind of situation. And so, I was kind of thinking of that, and then that conversation that they have in the bathroom at the hallway, where he's like, where Joel McHale's character is like, yeah, you were a good cook when you came to me and you left a great one. And so you're welcome, right? Like, but this idea that the only way that you can get to that point is by being abused the way that Joel McHale abuses Carmy. I really hope that's not true. I wonder, like, is it right? Because it's about a restaurant, but it's also about the act of being a creative person and creating anything. And, whether it's a TV show or journalism or whatever. And so as a writer, right, like I think about that, have I had the people in my life who have pushed me to be great? Would I be a better writer if I had been in an environment where someone pushed me a little harder maybe than I've been pushed? I don't know. I really hope the answer is no, right? Like I really hope that it doesn't take being tortured by someone like Joel McHale's character to achieve greatness. But kind of in the context of that, the conversation with David Chang, I did wonder about it. And yeah, but it is such an important scene. And clearly, like, Carmy is manifesting those behaviors, right? He's inflicting them on Sydney, right, and Richie and everyone else at the Bear. And it's driving them away, right? It's what's going to push Sydney to work for – it's what's going to push Sydney to leave and work for the guy from Ever. It's why Richie didn't pick up that fork when it fell on the ground, right? That's a key scene in episode 2 or 3. So we can't replicate that behavior. It's not conducive to being – a team, but on an individual level, yeah, I don't know. It's a I think we're supposed to be rooting for Carmi in that scene. And in some ways I wound up thinking that Joel McHale's character had a point, and maybe that doesn't speak well of my own mental health.
No, but I think that there's a new and different way to do it. And I think, you know, the people that are younger and are cooks are asking that of us in the kitchen, to find new solutions to how do we push ourselves, right? I think that I think you're absolutely right as far as the hours go. I don't think that you can be a great or amazing chef or storyteller with your food without putting in the hours yourself. And how do you breed what kind of levels out to be a little bit of obsession about food without that level of abuse? And, you know, I think I've worked for chefs that were maybe a little bit more like Joel McHale. I'm very lucky that the majority of the chefs that I worked for were very kind and patient. But I do think and hope that there's people that breed like more of like that competition as opposed to tearing people down, building people up as opposed to tearing people down. I was talking to Randall, who's the chef de cuisine over at Better Look Tomorrow. He likes using memes when we communicate. I was like, I sent him, he was a big Patriots fan. So I'm not sure if you know Patriots. Bill Belichick was, I would say had a very gruff demeanor, but I was like, the way that you do teams these days is, and I sent him a picture of DeMeco Ryans, and the way that will you build people up together as a team and breed that competition and put in the hours and do everything together in that sort of way, as opposed to just tearing people down.
Well, but he had the right. Carmi had those experiences, right? Danielle was very kind to him and patiently showed him how to make the fish with the potato crust. And Thomas Keller very patiently showed him how to truss a chicken in just such a way. And he, that got him to a certain level, right? Like the working for Olivia Colman's character, that got him to a certain level. But it wasn't until he went and worked for Joel McHale where he got told, like, actually, this is good, but it's not good enough, right? You need to push yourself harder. That's what unlocked that next level. That's what unlocked that fish dish that Sydney eats that is that aha moment for her. So, you know, maybe you need both, right? Maybe you need to be told you're good to be good. And then occasionally you need to be told that you suck to push you to work harder.
Doesn't mean that you shouldn't be able to receive criticism too, right? You know, everybody, you know, being able to push yourself also means that you have to be able to receive criticism, whether it be from the people that you work with or, I don't know, Yelp, right? You always have to take it. You have to always take some things with a grain of salt, but also take a look at it in a way where, like, hey, like, maybe this person has a point, even though they're like they're a Yelper or something like that.
Yeah, but just don't get into that rut like some people do, where you screenshot every negative Yelp review and then disagree with it on social media. I'm not going to name names, but there is one restaurant that maybe I've already mentioned in this podcast that comes to mind that does that. It's like, just be confident in what you do. Don't let one bad review like spoil your whole day.
I mean, just have confidence. Always be confident in yourself, and then be able to receive criticism and work with your team.
All right. Well, any other thoughts on season 3 of The Bear?
No, I think it's a great season to kind of set up for the next season. So I'm excited to personally, I'd love to see I'm really excited to see the review. I think that was a cliffhanger that they left us on. Excited to see the review and how well they do with both the either the success or the failure of the review.
Yeah. Do we think the show is going to have a happy ending? Are they going to get a Michelin star? It doesn't seem necessarily like the show. It doesn't necessarily seem like that kind of show that's going to have a feel good ending.
I mean, I guess that would make it for a much more interesting show. I would say that. But hopefully they get a star. The food looks like star food. Let's go with one. Looks like
one star. All right, Justin, you any other final thoughts on The Bear before we wrap this up?
No, thank you so much for chatting with me about a TV show.
Well, thanks for coming on and doing it. We'll do this again whenever after season four comes out.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking forward to it.
You want to plug social media, anything for T-Rex, Squabble, any of that stuff?
How about you just follow me? I'm at Tetsu Justin, T-E-T-S-U-J-U-S-T-I-N. But more so, I want to plug the city of Houston. You know, we had a tough week last week. Please find your favorite restaurant, support them. Support them with your bucks. Support them with good feelings, maybe a hug. That'd be great.
All right. That seems like a good place to wrap this up. Thank you so much for listening. You heard the Steakhouse Draft episode yesterday. We're doing the Bear today. And then on Thursday, I will be back with Andiron owner Michael Sandbrooks, who will pick a winner of our Steakhouse Draft episode. So stay tuned for that. And I will talk to you again very soon.
I loved all the chef cameos, which is maybe more of a shout out to me being a foodie.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip: when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Arr, fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.